From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the March 2016 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Bomb Girls. This month we bring you memories from the trailblazing women who were selected for Special Duties X or instructed to board the mythical HMS Pembroke 5 when they joined the Wrens, and found themselves operating state-of-the-art new machines at Bletchley Park, or one of its huge industrial outstations. We'll also find out about all the exciting things you can do with your children at Bletchley Park this Easter. Oh, sorry, had to be done. Don't forget, under-12s get free entry all year round, so it's exactly what you need for an Easter day out. Oh dear, moving on. Before all of that, it's time to introduce you to a dear friend of mine. Now, forgive me, this is a bit indulgent, but Helen Lee is pretty special. She's a BBC Three Counties Radio presenter, and we used to work together, starting at 5 o'clock every morning to make a breakfast show. She now presents the Sunday Breakfast Show, which you can find online if you don't happen to be listening to this podcast in either Bedfordshire, Hertfordshire or Buckinghamshire. Helen is also a ghostly figure projected onto a wall at Bletchley Park, as she was one of the volunteer actors who took part in creating the atmospheric interpretation of the code-breaking huts when they were restored in 2014. You can find her at the far end of Hut 6, pushing decoded messages through a chute to Hut 3. None of that is why you should hear this, though. Helen has been undergoing treatment for brain tumours, including major surgery. So we thought, who better to indulge in a bit of vintage glamour at the 1940s boutique? It's a day-long workshop and tutorial session, teaching you how to create the iconic wartime look with your hair in victory rolls and the tricks of make-do and mend makeup.
Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me. Anyone else but me. Anyone else but me. No, no, no. Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me. Till I come marching home.
So we're back at the 1940s boutique, the most glamorous day out that there is anywhere in the world, and certainly here at Bletchley Park. And I'm joined by the lovely Helen Lee from BBC Three Counties Radio. Now, you've had an interesting couple of years, to put it mildly, haven't you?
Yes. I look quite different, don't I? I've had cancer and lost all my hair. And I had lovely, long, blonde, straight hair before. And now it's come back, growing back after chemotherapy. It's dark and curly. So I'm not quite sure what to do with it. But when I was wearing a chemo hat, I was channeling the 1920s. And now I've got more hair growing back, I'd like to channel the 1940s. I really like the look and I really like the vintage. And I'm looking forward to a day of pampering. And
course,
glamour.
Yes, glamour. Very vintage glamour.
Yes.
It's very period appropriate. There are some ladies just arriving as we speak. Yeah. And some have come in lovely period costume and really stepped up
there.
To the game, haven't they? And some have come clearly just to glamorise themselves from the neck up.
Yes.
In the most fantastic way. So I'm really looking forward to this. What we'll do, we'll catch up with you throughout the day and find out how you're getting on.
Wonderful.
I'm not sure about this eyeliner, Helen. Do they look like...
They do look...
Those eyes belong to the
same
person.
Yes, they do. Maybe one of your eyes is a bit higher up than the other. Because you know our faces aren't symmetrical, you know that, don't
and
you?
And you don't see it...
In general, no one's
same
face
way
is symmetrical.
As you see someone else's face, because you're looking at a mirror
no,
image.
No, exactly.
This is another level of weird.
I think that the... So you've got the cat's eye eyeliner, which interestingly, Sarah says, isn't particularly authentic to the 40s because they wouldn't have had the eyeliner. This is the modernised version of the 40s look.
Eyeliner is huge now,
I know
isn't
it is.
It's
it
very
is.
Important.
I've always wanted to have that cat's eye look. But no, I think that you've actually done it nicely. I'm not there yet. I'm still doing my eyeshadow.
Ah. Should I have done that first?
Probably.
Yes.
Okay. We will go on and on and sit down under the apple tree. Maybe just you and me when I come marching home.
So tell me about the morning session.
There was a lot to do with makeup, which I didn't know, like warming the makeup on your hand first, instead of just using the makeup
on your face straight away cold, your makeup needs to be the same temperature as your skin. Otherwise, it won't go on. This is where I've been going wrong all these years.
It sounds obvious, doesn't it? But
it
actually,
does.
When you know that, it makes so much sense.
And in the 40s, they didn't use makeup brushes or anything, because they used them mainly their fingers, which of course is the same thing, because your fingers are the same temperature and it makes it go on easier.
So, you've had a revelation with that.
Yes, with that. And also, the tip about the eyeliner, I've always had a problem with doing the eyeliner. So, once you've got your eyeliner warm, sticking it along as close to the lashes as possible, but stretching the skin as well. Now, I've got a few wrinkles, laughter lines, I believe they're called, and pulling your skin with a liquid liner is not good. No, I don't either. And Sarah was saying that if you use a gel, then it's a lot easier. Now, that is the one thing that she suggested using a brush with, which they would have done before. So, and also defining your eyebrows. That's what I've learned this morning.
Of all the boys I've known, and I've known some, until I first met you, I was lonesome. And when you came in sight, to do my heart grew light, and this whole world seemed to me. You're really swell, I have to admit you. Deserve expressions that been.
My name's Tammy. I work at Let's Sleep Out.
And you were the model for today, weren't you?
Yes, I was.
Don't you look absolutely stunning? Is this a look that you would normally go for?
I've modelled a couple of times here, and it's not something I would have done before, but now, having seen it, it's something I use the tricks and everyday makeup that I've been doing, so I'm learning a lot.
That's good to know. Your hair, however, which is long and blonde, it's beautiful. She's curled it. I don't know what she's done with it, really, to be honest. But it's really curly.
And it's staying.
Yeah.
Which is quite amazing.
Do you think you could recreate it at home?
I'm going to be honest, I have tried. I've tried with the little clips to let it set.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't hold as long as when she does it. So I don't know if I need to hairspray more or more product.
Maybe.
Trial and error, I think it's going to be.
I think going back to the 40s, where they didn't have all the products that we did, it must have taken them ages and ages to do this. I mean, it took Sarah showing us, it took 45 minutes for an hour to do your hair.
Yeah.
I can't imagine doing that.
No, and they used hot iron as well, didn't they?
Exactly.
Surprised they had any hair left.
Funny beast to shame. Please let me explain. Funny beast to shame. Is that your grand? Funny beast to shame.
What would be your top tip for vintage look? Your number one top tip?
Oh, that's good. My top tip for vintage hair would definitely be patience and backcombing, because you need a lot of patience to get your backcombing. I'm cheating here.
Okay.
And for vintage makeup, a good quality black eyeliner and a steady hand.
Okay. Can you help me with that steady hand thing?
Absolutely.
Okay, so I've got a massive, essentially felt tip pen.
These are great. Well, do you know, the reason these are so good is because I'm just going to draw this on the back of my hand here. The nib of this is so fine that actually I've got really great control with the product.
Okay.
And if I want to do a sort of a winged look, I just sort of press as I go.
And that's the key, isn't it? To have a winged look.
Softly, and softly with the winged look. Because the problem is, if you go too hard at the end, you get the sort of panda eye, and then, you know, you're into sort of more 60s makeup.
Whereas
you want to keep it very light for the 40s.
Is that authentic for the 40s?
The 40s, not so much. I mean, when we talk about sort of vintage makeup, vintage is sort of a hodgepodge of sort of different looks. You've got a bit of an Elizabeth Taylor eye going on. You know, you've got the red lip, which is very Rita Hayworth, which is like early 30s, sort of mid 40s. But you've got to remember, things were scarce in the 40s. People, if they had it, would have worked with the makeup they had. Otherwise, you know, it was good skincare and, you know, wash your hair when you can.
Yeah.
So it's sort of what we're doing now is basing it upon the sort of glamorous film star element of it, really. And we're in Hollywood, maybe a little bit in the makeup with what we've got today, but it's still very much based on that sort of authentic look.
I could say Bella, Bella, even say Wunderbar. Each language only helps me tell you how red you are.
Hair-wise, can anyone with any
hair type?
Do you know, absolutely.
Do the vintage style?
I think you can. I think you just have to work out what suits you. So some products that work for my really heavy hair wouldn't work for somebody else's very fine hair.
Yeah.
And you know what? It's just having the confidence with it as well. And that's what we try and do today. Build up the confidence with people so that they don't feel like they're doing it wrong, because there is no wrong answer. You know, you're inspired by something, you're taking that, and you're wearing it how you want to wear it. You're taking everything I'm teaching and you're putting your own spin on it. I think that's really important, that the people here will go away with their own sort of individual look to it. There's sort of no right and wrong.
It's like a toolkit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you go away with good tips and some cheats as well. Yeah. You know, we'll give you some little cheats to do to kind of cut your time down in the bathroom. But, you know, in general, it's very much obviously inspired by the women of the park. And, you know, just getting that look.
When the women who worked at Bletchley Park were here, would they have been spending hours and hours a day on their hair and on their makeup?
I very much doubt it, because there would have been so little around. I mean, we have an abundance of product, but they would have got probably quite handy with home remedies.
Yeah.
Although they wouldn't have been spending hours on their looks, it probably would have been still quite time consuming just through the lack of things. You know, if you washed your hair and you have no shampoo, you're probably making
as often, did they?
No, and this is the thing that's quite fun telling everyone on these sort of courses. Every 2 weeks of washing your hair is great to watch everyone's faces in horror.
You like my smile, you like my style, why don't you make me know it? You like my walk, you like my talk, but there's only one way to show it.
Does the vintage look work with short, dark hair?
Do you know
hair?
What I always think as well? I mean, I was saying there's some ladies here who are doing a play as well. You can take little bits of different eras. So short hair was quite fashionable in the 30s, and there's no reason you can't put a little curl and a little wave and have a sort of late 30s, early 40s look, which is incredibly glamorous. It's just a slightly darker lip and a thinner brow and slightly more sort of slicked hair. But again, you know, again in the 50s as well, you've got those sort of shorter hair sets. And there would have been a lot of people who obviously didn't change the hair in the 40s, would have kept the looks of the 30s. So there's sort of no need to do a completely sort of, you know, by numbers 40s look. People say, oh, should I cut my hair for this? You never change what you have, you know. You don't want to have to do this every day. I mean, I have to do this every day. But that's, you know, how my hair's cut and how everything now works. Otherwise, I have a slightly interesting mullet going on. It's one of those things where you can make this look work for you. A lot of my clients with short hair would curl it and put like a fabulous felt hat or something on with some feathers. And, you know, headwear and accessories make such a difference. Like the beautiful bandana, and, you know, having that immediately, you know, ties you to that era.
Well, you were rocking the hats for a while, weren't you?
I was, which was quite a 1920s style.
Oh, nice.
I like the cloche hat with the flower inside accessory. But yeah, now it's... Yeah, it's growing. So I'm just, you know, trying to rock a different look.
When I first started out doing this, I had really short hair, and it was a case of just, you know, learning to curl it when it's short. It's actually quite nice, because by the time it's long, you've got that down. So it's sort of, you know, your skills will grow with the hair. And you'll sort of learn lots of different things, and things will change. And it's why we sort of say, you know, try lots of products, get out there, try lots of things. Because, you know, somebody will stumble across something and say, oh, this works brilliantly for me. How do I live without it? But it might not work for my hair type.
If you want to shake my hand like they do it in Harlem, stick your hand right out and shout, give me some skin, my friend, step right up.
Do you know what? I think it's just... it's so part of the psyche now. If you go into, you know, high street shops, there's
popular,
full skirts, petticoats, you know, it's incredible. It's really transcended. And I think it's nice. It's stopped being so niche and started being a bit more sort of... out there, you know, I go to weddings and people are in full gathered skirts. It's kind of nice.
It's just going to make your bookings diary all more busy, isn't it?
Well, but, you know, I used to say to people, where are you going? They'd be going to a 40s event. Now I say, where they're going? Just going down the pub. It's definitely crossed over, and I think vintage clothing had, and now hair and makeup sort of caught up, and now it's barbering. Like, men are really getting into the whole barbering thing, the treatments. It's really going, the whole shebang.
I'll be glad when we see the back of that groomed hair and that awful beard.
So much money on beard oil is spent in our house. It's ridiculous. The boyfriend has the big full.
Oh, I said that. Yeah. I just realised he's open.
Oh, he can't hear you. He's fine. He won't care. Do you know what, though? The amount of products he now buys is really interesting. He's got half the cabinet, so, you know. Times are changing.
Children under 12 get free entry to Bletchley Park all year round, and there's plenty to entertain all ages this Easter. We've got workshops where maths and codes meet art, trails around the site specially for children, and for the adults, there's a chance to win a Suzuki Vitara. I had a chat with Bletchley Park's Head of Education, Kate Travers, about how this is learning by stealth.
The trail is for families and children to do together to discover the park through number. So it might be that they just want to hop, skip, jump along the path, and the answers that they get for how many hops or skips or jumps they've done between one object and another is obviously going to vary, so they can talk about it.
Oh, so it's breaking down bits of the site and discovering it in a different way through numbers.
Yes. I see. Yeah. Counting things, measuring things, guessing the height of something, finding the tallest tree, looking for the time on the clock.
Is there such a thing as a set of correct answers that they get later, or is it sort of...
No, this is the challenge and the fun of the trail, that the answers will depend on what they decide to do and what sort of answer they want. So if they want to count their little paces from one place to another, that's going to be different to if they're an adult and they've got larger paces.
Striding. Great bounds.
Yes.
It gives a bit of storytelling and it makes them think about the challenges as well, because in the way, if there are sort of no right answers, who knew what the answer was to the code-breaking problems people were facing here during World War II? That's quite a nice link, isn't it?
Yeah, it's lovely. So it's about them doing something in their own way, but then also thinking about how they can work with other people to find an answer and then think about why their answers might be different or the same.
More importantly, though, all of this is fun.
And yeah, it's
amazingly
fun.
That's why you should bring your children. Not because you're going to give them a lesson, because you don't want them to get into the school holidays and think, oh, I don't want to go to more school. But no, it's not like that, is it?
No, that's what's fun about it, that you can do what you want to do and you can explore in your own way. And it's just really a helpful guide. It's just a different kind of map around the park.
There are not just trails over Easter available laid on for children to give you extra reasons to come with your kids over the Easter holidays. Main of which, of course, is that children under 12 come in free all year round. Don't forget that. There are also some workshops laid on. Tell me about Crafty Codes.
Crafty Codes is a fun and creative way to find out about coding and code breaking. The idea is that you can just come along, create your own gift card, and using different types of stitches, you can write your own secret message there.
So is it Morse code? You're stitching in Morse code?
It could be Morse code. It could be any kind of code. It's quite open and inspirational.
Excellent. And Think Make Do is on the following day. That's Easter Monday.
Yes, that's really useful for younger children, so from 4, 5 upwards. And there's a range of activities, so they can create their own code or message using sound. There's an opportunity for them to do some drawing or writing. There's a mirror writing activity. They can have a go at binary bangles.
Binary bangles.
Yep. So you can wear them all day long. And if they're really enjoying binary bangles, they can also look at Morse code bracelets too. And then for the older children, they can do all of those activities. But if they want to challenge themselves a little bit and have even more fun, they can get involved in some code breaking challenges.
There's lots on. And of course, even on a day when those workshops aren't running, which they're just over the Easter weekend, and that's when you can win a car as well, by the way, if you come and register with Suzuki. There's plenty that's dotted around the site that kind of divides a family in a good way. So for example, the multimedia guide has a children's version and an adult's version. So you can be walking along side by side and completely engaged without having to sort of dumb down or try and get children to come up to the adult complicated level.
The multimedia guides are brilliant for engaging the entire family, in that you can access information about the site at your own level, so children can play games on there whilst adults are perhaps listening to one of the videos that are on there, and you can explore and find together. So a really useful, fun activity.
And there's lots of interactive opportunities around the site, hands-on. What I like when I see children exploring the site is that I remember going to a museum as a child or a gallery, and it was all very sort of stiff and formal, if you like, don't touch. But it's not the case here, is it? You like people to be able to get in and kind of have quite a tactile experience, gently. gently, of course.
Yeah, the hands-on learning experience is really important for engaging everybody, and it keeps things fun, light-hearted. People can just have fun on an activity at their own level, and it's also a wonderful site in that you can explore it and walk around it, so you can happily use some of your energy finding out about the park outdoors as well as indoors.
This month's It Happened Here story is about women and machines, in a time when some people might still have said those two things didn't mix. Wrens who joined up to do their bit went for basic training, and a few were singled out for Special Duties X, or told their posting would be to HMS Pembroke 5. Those girls, and I call them girls because they were mostly young, found themselves at Bletchley Park or one of its outstations, operating futuristic machines which helped to find daily Enigma settings much faster than it could be done by hand. They were the Bomb Girls. Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, has been talking to podcast producer Mark Cotton about those early days.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
Last month, when we looked at the start of the special relationship between Britain and America and the visit of those first four American codebreakers in 1941, one of the things that they were shown was one of the most secret things that Britain had at that time, which was the Turing Welshman bomb. David's with me this month, and we're going to look at the bomb, but more specifically, the people who ran the bomb and how they first came to Bletchley Park 75 years ago to help run these absolutely essential machines that helped break Enigma. So, David, when the Americans came in February 41, the first few bombs were actually here, weren't they?
Yes, the first bomb was delivered in March 1940, Turing's basic design. And then he and Welshman worked on that, and Welshman came up with his diagonal board, which is famous for making the machine more effective. And then a second machine arrived in August of 1940, and those two machines were running up until sort of Christmas 1940. The first real breaks they got with those machines were after August, in September, October. And by the end of the year, they had managed to break 178 jobs, as it was called, keys had been figured out. So by Christmas 1940, the machines were running, but obviously they only had two of them. And at that point, they were in Hut 1, which is a tiny space.
Yeah.
And there were only three people, apart from Turing and Welshman themselves, there were only three people operating the machines. They had a tri-service team, as it was called, which consisted of one bloke from the RAF, one bloke from the Army, one bloke from the Navy. Sergeant Jones from the RAF ran operations in Hut 1. He's an interesting figure because he carried on running bomb operations on the technical side throughout the rest of the war. And he finishes the war as a squadron leader. He gets sort of gradually promoted as his role expands as the war goes on. So you have Sergeant Jones and his two chums in Hut 1 with Victory, which was the first bomb machine. And then Agnes Day, the name given to machine number 2, arrives. Nobody ever called it Agnes Day. It became rechristened Agnes with an E very quickly. And then in March, British Tabulating Machines, who are building the bombs in Letchworth, start being able to produce machines on a regular basis. So it's clear that increasing numbers of machines are going to arrive from spring of 1941 onwards. So they have to figure out a way of, firstly, accommodating them, and secondly, manning them. Well, manning them is the wrong word because it turned out to be wrens, but providing operators for them. So the first thing they do is they build Hut 11, which had room in it for up to 6 machines. And in March 1941, they move into Hut 11 with initially the 3 machines they've got in March and then increasing numbers after that.
Do we know why the wrens were specifically picked?
Well, actually, it's there was some resistance to them being used at all. I mean, by 1941, there was an obvious incentive to use women where possible because men were required for combat roles and things. And the Navy had access to wrens who could do the work. Initially, there was a certain amount of scepticism about whether wrens would be able to do it, and it was basically 1940 sexism. There was no part of the job they couldn't do. There was a suggestion that because the machines are up to 7 feet tall, that you needed quite tall women who could reach the top knobs, if you like, and also that it's quite a physically demanding role. Actually, as the war went on, wrens of all shapes and sizes did the job perfectly adequately. So it was mainly the prejudice of the times as much as anything. But they were persuaded that these were a suitable source of personnel. And so the reason we're mentioning it now is because 75 years ago this month, on the 24th of March 1941, the first eight wrens arrive here at Bletchley to operate bomb machines. And they are the first eight of nearly 3,000 women who come through the Bletchley Park operation, not just here on site, but at the other outstations
as well.
They go from eight on the establishment to 1,800. By 1945, there are nearly 2,000 of them. Obviously, because some of them don't stay, there's a turnover of personnel. Nearly 3,000 women are involved filling those 1,800 jobs through the war. A huge portion of the Bletchley Park workforce were these bomber operator wrens. And because a lot of them were very young women, they were in their late teens, early 20s, they also form a big chunk of our surviving veteran population. They're a big part of our story. But it's 75 years ago this month that the first eight arrived, and no doubt with absolutely no idea what to expect or what they were going to do.
You talk about Hut 11. The information from Hut 11, where was that going? It was just going across the road. And they didn't even know that.
When I was working the bombs, I knew I was connected to one of the huts by this red voice scrambling telephone, so that when we got a good stop, we would phone it through. But to actually see the inside of Hut 6 and listen to the facsimile of the people saying, oh, we've broken in, and jumping up and down. You know, in those days, it was just an impersonal red telephone. But in fact, there were real people at the other end of that phone, and this is where they were, in these dingy, dusty, boring rooms. And we, as bomb operators, thought our machine rooms, where we had the bombs, were dingy, dusty and dirty. But they were palatial in comparison to those dark, very sparse rooms in Hut 6. But the working conditions were even more miserable than ours were. We never knew what went on. I mean, nobody knew. I mean, it's very probable that those first people who were breaking codes when the only few bombs that we had were in Hut 11, they also had to phone their stops through on a voice scrambler. They didn't know it was going to a hut across the pavement. And maybe the people in Hut 6 didn't know that their stops were coming from across the pavement either.
People know that there's this machine called the bomb, and through the film like Imitation Game and Bletchley Circle, they've seen versions of it. What was it designed to do? Because we didn't put German code messages into one end and they came out in plain English, did they? Which a lot of people could easily think is what happened.
Absolutely. There is this misapprehension that it deciphers messages for you. It doesn't do that at all. Each day, or typically each day, although it varies slightly, the German radio operators would set up their Enigma machine in a particular way. They'd put particular rotors in the machine, and then they'd start their encryption with those rotors set in certain positions. And you also have what's called a plug board on the front, which was set up in different ways. Those settings of the machine are called a daily key. And if you have that information, you can decode all the messages that are sent on that network. So the bomb's job is to unpick what those individual machine settings are. And even there, it doesn't do the whole job. It does part of the job, but narrows down the number of options that a person working with a pencil and paper has to deal with, from, you know, 150 billion down to sometimes hundreds, sometimes tens. How it does that is by the use of what's called a crib, which is where you essentially guess what you think part of the message content might be.
Because the Germans were quite set in their ways, weren't they? They had a certain way of sending certain messages, so the U-boats would always send a weather forecast, wouldn't they?
Yes, they have, the term used is stereotyped message forms. So they would compose a message in the same way quite frequently, and so that the introduction of the message, who it's to, for example, could often be predicted. sign-offs at the end could be predicted. And in particular, in relation to naval messages, you've mentioned weather forecasts, they had separate code books that allowed them to transmit information about things like weather in a shortened form,
yeah.
but always in a very predictable form.
Yeah.
So the machine is predicated on the idea that if you can get a section of message text that you can guess with reasonable certainty, and you need around a dozen characters typically, you take those letters, and what you do on the bomb is you select which rotors you think the Germans might be using, and you set up those rotors on the bomb machine. And because it has three ranks of rotors, you can set more than one combination of rotors on one machine. And then you take your predicted text and basically wire up the rotors so that when they click through all the different possible combinations of position, for each position, an electric current is passed through the rotors, which tests whether it's possible, putting it very simply, to get those plain text letters from those encrypted letters. It's not as simple as that, but that's broadly what it's doing. It tests each of those circuits electronically over and over until it finds one that is logically consistent. And at that point, the machine stops and the settings can be read off and you get part way to having the key.
Listen to them all. Clickety-click. All those wheels whirling round and you're just recording the stops. It's like churning blooming butter on a hot day. Eventually, though, the butter will come and the messages can be decoded and lots of lives will be saved. If not, probably someone's had it. Oh, looks like we've got some results. Hello, this is Greece. We've got a good stop on Athens. The letters are O, U, G and L. We've just got to wait now.
That's not the end of the story. That information then has to be taken away and tested again manually on a thing called a checking machine, which has more rotors on it and is operated by hand. But that whole process means ultimately you can get to a point where you know the key, you know the settings for that day on that network.
Yeah.
And then it's simply a case of collecting all the traffic from that network, putting those settings onto one of the Enigma analog machines we have, the Typex machines that were set up to work like Enigmas. And then you can start typing traffic through and out comes the decrypted version of it. One of the things that people don't appreciate about them is we tend to talk about the bomb singular. And yes, Turing and Welshman created one machine initially. But because the Germans are sending thousands and thousands of messages every day, having just one machine doesn't really help you, because if you can only break one key at a time, you're not going to be able to read anything like enough traffic.
A lot of people don't realise it's not just one network either, is it?
No,
it's multiple networks.
It's multiple networks, and those keys are changing at least daily. Towards the latter part of the war, they're changing several times a day. There are many, many different keys required to be broken every day. So the more machines you have, the more traffic you can tackle. And so what they do, which is quite risky, really, is in 1940, Turing and Welshman are still struggling to get the machine to work well. But they think they're close enough that with sort of tweaks and fiddles, it'll work. And so they commission BTM to start mass production, even though they don't know what the finished machine is going to look like. And so BTM start manufacturing machines, and they get to a point where they're turning out nearly a machine a week. And so at that point, they order sort of, I can't remember how many it is in the first instance, I think 25 or 50 or whatever. But before the order is ever completed, the order is always increased, you know, up until 1943 when they change things over. But Travis and Welshman here at Bletchley are confronted with the problem of, if in 6 months' time we're going to have 30 or 40 or even 50 of these things, where do we put them? What do we do with them? And this is when the concept of the outstation starts. Because the other point is, if they put all their bomb machines in a very large Hut 11 and a German bomb fell on it, we're scuppered. And if you think, several German bombs fell on the site in October or November 1940. So relatively recently, bombs have landed on the site, albeit by accident. So the threat is real, even though it transpired that the site would never be attacked. It was always a risk. So the plan from the outset is to disperse the machines to other locations not too far away, but far enough away that they're secure. So the first outstation, so-called, is OSA, which is Adstock Manor, which is a short distance from Bletchley. It's a small country house, if you like, and they took over the stable block and put ultimately five machines and their operators in that stable block. They also took over Wavendon House, and there they built a purpose-built building, a bit like Hut 11. It was a sort of splinter-proof concrete structure. It was hidden in the woods in the grounds. And again, that had five machines in it. By the end of 1941, they have 16 machines up and running, but they're already anticipating getting more, and that number rises to, by 1945, there's approximately 200 machines running in this country at five different locations.
Well, I was a bomb operator at Eastcote on Sea Watch. The machines never stopped. They went for 24 hours. You had to work in shifts, eight-hour shifts, which meant sometimes you were working all night, three watches, and the other watch was on leave. Because we didn't know anything about Alan Turing then, or even the word Enigma.
But did you know that you were obviously helped break the codes?
Yeah, so they said that then, that we all had to sign the Official Secrets Act. And my husband, who he was in the army, didn't know anything from me until 25 years later when it suddenly came up on the television. This girl was talking about this bomb. And I don't know him, I swear, but I said to myself, bloody hell, I said, that's what I was doing. Nobody told me I could talk about it.
The additional problem they have is not only do they need to find places for the buildings to live, if you like, the operators also have to be accommodated somewhere as well. So some outstations have wrens living on site. Other outstations don't, and those wrens in turn are billeted in other places. So you end up with a list of something like 11 different, typically sort of small country houses around the Bletchley, now Milton Keynes area, that either had wrens running bombs in them or had wrens living in them. I mean, one example is Walton House, which is now part of the Open University.
Famously Woburn Abbey.
I always think it's interesting that the RAF build a camp out the back of Bletchley and put people in wooden huts, and the army do the same and build their own camp out the back. The Navy don't. They just requisition Woburn Abbey.
Yeah.
Gives you an idea of how the Navy does business.
But they weren't living in the land of luxury in Woburn Abbey, were they?
I mean, as far as I can tell, the Duke panelled over everything with plywood and then switched the heating off and left.
I didn't like Woburn Abbey. It was cold, and I fell down the curly staircase, you know, and it was stone steps, and I ended up in the hospital. And the pub was about nearly a mile away, so we go down there and have a drink. We've got to get all the way back, because no transport. I mean, you have to remember just blackouts, but no names of any roads or anything like that. Coming here, saying to Vicky, because in the old days, you never had a name on a road or a lane or no signpost where you're going. You forget that.
The other question that arose was what title to give these people. I mean, you couldn't call them bomb operators because it would have given something away. So initially they just got the title Special Duties. Special Duties was a category of Wren that did all sorts of different jobs, shortened to SD. Specifically for the bomb operators here, they were given the title Special Duties X. And that was a reference to Station X, Bletchley Park. That happened in the spring of 1942. But it became apparent that as more and more of them were appointed, and this term Station X, you know, what's the X stand for? Oh, that's Station X. That got bandied about more and more. They felt that it was attracting
the wrong sort of attention.
Wrong sort of attention. An aura of glamour and secrecy that they didn't really want. So in November 42, the Admiralty sent out a memo declaring that the term Station X should no longer be used, and the much duller title of HMS Pembroke was allocated to Wren bomb operators. Because in the Navy, shore stations are named as if they were ships, even though they're not at sea. So HMS Pembroke is created, which is a nice, boring title for all the Wren operators. So they cease being Special Duties X, and they become Special Duties at HMS Pembroke.
Do we know at all what they were looking for in the Wrens that they selected? Because none of our Wrens that we speak to ever seem to know specifically why they were selected. They go off to their basic training. There's something that is seen in them in their basic training. And then, you know, we have many stories of how they were first told they were going to go to Bletchley.
I've not seen any paperwork on their specific sort of qualifications or criteria. I mean, obviously, I think they were looking for the brighter, more diligent ones that they felt were sort of more responsible. They're not looking for example, in some cases, wrens with language skills were filtered out. And some of those worked in different bits of the Bletchley Park operation. But for bomb operation, no language skills are required. So they weren't, for example, looking for people who could speak German. The ones who could speak German were taken away to do different tasks. But I think they were looking for a level of attention to detail, responsibility, seriousness, if you like, in the people that they were recruited. It didn't always work. I mean, there are cases where women were recruited and they go through a basic training period and it's decided that they're not psychologically, you know, up for it, and they get moved on. There is also a number of people who leave. The reasons given for there being 3,000 filling 1,800 jobs. Scott Anita Jones's report describes the fact that a number of them leave because they get married.
We have a family connection with the Navy, always have had, and I wanted to go in the Wrens. The Wrens was the only one of the three women's services that had a pre-service training. The other people went straight in. We didn't. We had a pre-service training of a fortnight, and during that time, if they didn't like the look of us, they would tell us to go home, and we'd immediately be called up for the Land Army or some ATS or something else. And some people were sent home. It wasn't a myth. I was called up and asked to report up to Tullyhewan Castle in Scotland, and it was a lovely castle up on the hill, but that was the Holy of Holies where the officers lived. And we were down in Nissen huts down below, and I was allotted a bunk and so on. And during the fortnight we were there, we weren't aware of it, but we were obviously being very closely watched. They put us through our paces. They gave us filthy cleaning jobs to do and that sort of thing, just to see what we were made of, really. I didn't mind because I thought I'll do anything, you know, and I got stuck into anything. But I was told afterwards, because the officer who recruited me, I became great friends with her later on. And so during the second week, six of us were told to report up to the castle, which was, as I say, the Holy of Holies. And we thought, my goodness, what have we done wrong? We were told to line up in alphabetical order. And one by one, we were called into the room. And the first one came out. We said, you know, what's it all about? And she just walked straight past us and out the door. And this happened with each one until it got to my turn, and I was the next to last. And poor old Pro Wren Wright, who had to be left on her own, I said, don't worry, I'll tell you whatever it is. So I walked into the room, and to my amazement and rather, well, horror really, there was a long, very long oak table. Behind it, in the middle, was a Wren officer. This Wren officer, I said, I later got to know very well. And there were various other officers of different forces and one or two civilians. They sat there, and I went up and saluted the officer, and she told me to stand at ease. She talked to me for a little while, and then she said, well, we want you to do something which is very, very secret, but we can't tell you what it is. But when you leave this room, you mustn't mention this conversation to any living person. Is that understood? Yes, ma'am, it is understood. And she said, is anything you want to say? And I said, no, thank you, ma'am. And saluted and about turned and went out of the door, of course, right past poor Pro Wren Wright. And we were very quickly removed. We didn't complete the second week.
Now, the reason you can be so pinpoint accurate about how many bombs were here is because we've actually got the documentation, haven't we?
Yes. Later in 1942, the role of looking after all of the bomb operations was passed to a chap called Fletcher, and he kept what are essentially things that look like hardback school exercise books. There's two of them in the National Archives, known as Mr. Fletcher's bomb books. And in there, there is a page for every machine that was produced in serial number order, explaining when they were manufactured, which outstations they went to, when they were taken in for repair, and all the rest of it. And what's striking, if you look at the data in those books, is how mobile the machines were. People have the idea that one might be manufactured and sent to an outstation, and that was the end of it. And the bombs all had names. This is something people are relatively familiar with, but what people don't appreciate is the name referred to the location rather than the machine itself. So, for example, at Stanmore, where the machines are allocated to bays, each bay has about 10 machines in it, and each of the bays is named after a Commonwealth country. So you have a South Africa bay, a New Zealand bay, an Australia bay, and in those bays, each machine location is named after a city. So you get Sydney, Melbourne, Darwin, you know, Quebec, Alberta, Vancouver in the Canadian bay. But the machine that occupies that bay may not necessarily be the same machine all the way along. If that machine needs servicing, it gets taken away and another machine is brought along and put in that bay and takes on the name. So when you read the bomb book, it will say machine number 42 started out under this name and then moved to a different station and was given a different name and then moved again to another station and might be given a different name. Also, in the latter part of the war, they've changed the design. So they have a lot of what are called new standard machines and the older machines from earlier in the war. And they reshuffle them so they get the same machine types in particular locations because it assists with the servicing and everything else. What's really striking about this is how mobile the machines are. They're not only moving between outstations, they're also going back to Letchworth to be repaired and coming out again. But what is amazing is, as I understand it, there was one lorry and one driver for the whole war. And he was the bomb delivery man. When they finished them at BTM in Letchworth, they would roll them out onto the loading dock. The lorry had a special ramp and winch so the machine could be winched into the back of the lorry. And they would basically just throw the tarpaulins down on the side of the lorry and he would drive off. And he didn't have special outrider escort or anything else. He just travelled incognito in a truck with a bit of stuff in the back of it. His secrecy was based on the fact that he was completely inconspicuous.
Yeah.
And that truck and that driver spent the whole war delivering machines, collecting machines for repair, taking machines from one place to another. And they never saw the need to fit out more than one lorry. So it was just this one chap. I've not been able to find out what his name was, but he was certainly kept busy.
I was based at Stanmore, which was one of the outstations for Bletchley, and I was a bomb operator. I came to Bletchley once because I was sent up on remand because I'd been late three times for duty. And so I had to come and see the chief officer up here for a telling off. She said to me, "Well, you must do better than this." And I said, "Yes, ma'am." And so it said, "Instead, your next time off after the 12 o'clock shift, you're going to stay at Stanmore and do housework for half the day. And then I hope you'll behave better in future."
And we haven't told you off today.
No, luckily. I never thought I'd see it again.
I don't suppose you did, no. I don't know if this rings any bells. That's a menu. That's what you use.
That's what I plug in. Yes, but it was a scrappy board. I would have been given on a scrappy piece of paper what I had to plug in, and I would stand here and plug it in.
Yeah. Did you use a trolley resembling that one to carry the cables?
No. They just brought them down by hand. The only trolley which went round was one with ghastly camp coffee and stuff on it. Yes, but when you think of it, 8 hours is a long time that the shifts were. And you had half an hour break in the middle when you went back and had a meal or something. Then the drums, of course, that took much longer getting the drums on because they'd tell you the setting. And it was this checking all those wires that none of the wires touched. And that was
a pair of tweezers.
Yes, that's right. Absolutely amazing when you think. But they still found it was worthwhile us doing it because they got enough, results. And all they would come in and say, you know, job up, and everyone said good, but we just knew that blue was Navy and brown was Army, and that was all. And they went on the theory that at least information we knew, the better. All signed the Official Secrets Act, and if we'd split or anything, we'd have been shot at dawn. But, it's amazing that everybody kept it, isn't it? Until 1975, I hadn't told my husband or anything.
No.
And now what, we've got Twitter and everything,
you
don't
you? You're
telling everybody everything,
The benefit of it, though, in terms of reading German traffic, if you look at the teleprints of messages around D-Day, which is something I've been doing recently, if you look at the time of origin of some of those messages, the time the Germans sent the message, which is recorded in the teleprint, and then the time of the teleprint itself, which is a fully decrypted version of the message, in some cases you're talking as little as a couple of hours. And that shows just how slick this operation has got, that by 1944, traffic is coming in, they're finding a suitable crib, they're getting that out to a bomb machine, they're getting the rundown on the bomb, they're getting a stop back, they're using that to establish a key, and they're starting to read traffic within a few hours of that key change at midnight, which means that by the time the invasion happens at 6 a.m, some of those German keys have already been broken. So German traffic is essentially being read in near real time as the invasion is happening. And not just a few messages either, many thousands of messages. And one of the things they do for D-Day is they institute an additional, essentially a Y station. They start intercepting traffic here on site at Bletchley for a short period. And what that means is on the morning of the invasion, you can see some of the traffic is already decrypted and being teleprinted within a couple of hours of it being transmitted by the Germans. So it can be argued that in some cases, the British commanders were knowing things before the German commanders intended for.
Definitely. Yeah.
Prior to D-Day, the operation is supported by a lot of intelligence being gained that is about German defensive positions and how many tanks they've got, how many men they've got, which isn't necessarily time-critical information. But the key breaking and bomb operating operation becomes so slick that once the invasion has happened, they're able to feed back almost real-time intelligence. And that's a huge bonus to the commanders in France. You know, on a daily basis, they're reading messages that were sent that day. And the example that's often quoted is the German counterattack at Mortain, which Montgomery and Eisenhower knew about the operation before it was launched. And they were able to get the RAF and the US Army Air Force to bomb the German troop concentrations building up for the attack. And basically, the attack is doomed before it starts because we already know about it. And being able to get an intelligence cycle that's that quick is fantastic for the operations on the ground, you know.
It's one of those really specific points in time that we can look to and say, you know, the effect that Bletchley had. These bomb machines were absolutely fundamental to our ability to read Enigma traffic, weren't they? And they were put basically in the hands of 18, 19, 20-year-old girls, as they like to still be called.
Very much so, yes. And it's a heavy responsibility because if you don't plug up the machine correctly or you misset the drums or whatever, a whole run could be wasted. You could miss the setting that you're looking for. And so there's a need for real dedication and precision about what they're doing. And also in the maintenance of the machines, you know, the fact that the drums had to be physically inspected and made sure that all the brushes were in position, all that sort of thing, before you fitted them on. It wasn't a job that you could rush or, you know, be sloppy about.
Have you all heard the bombs going round? They make quite a lot of noise, and if you multiply that by anything up to a dozen, that would be the first thing that would hit you. The noise of these bombs clicking round when you went into this enormous room, and also you would have the smell of the oil, and you would also have not very much proper daylight because there were wartime fluorescent lights. And they flickered. They were quite bright, although in the middle of the night they seemed to take on a sort of greenish hue, as often the bomb operators did too, about 4 o'clock in the morning. However, you went in and you took over from whoever was operating your bomb, and from then on it was a pretty active time because the bombs took 15 minutes to do a run. During this time, you were tweezing out the drums that had been taken off the machine. You had to take off usually at least 36 drums every 15 minutes, and you put them on the table behind you and hastily put on a fresh row of drums and set it going again, and off they went, clickety-click, and you had to tweeze these. And they put the fear of the Lord into you if you didn't do it properly, because there were lots of these little wire brushes with 19 strands in each. They all had to be tweezed out so that they didn't touch one another. And they also had to be put on properly to the bomb machine when they were ready to be put on, because they had to make perfect contact with the little commutators that were on the machine itself. And the whole bomb could go wrong if those wires were not properly tweezed. So you were tweezing away. At the same time, if your bomb stopped, you had to write down the information that was offered to you. You rushed through to the back of the bigger bomb bay and you put it through the hatch to your checker, who would check the stop. Then you would run back in case the machine stopped again. And when all that was done, you had a little logbook on the table and you had to write down the wheel orders, what had been run, and the number of stops and any remarks, not necessarily polite, but nevertheless, we tried our best. You and your checker always worked as a pair to plug up the plugs at the back. And when you'd plug them up properly, it looked a little bit like Spaghetti Junction, but it all worked out well in the end. And the only exciting bit really was if you were lucky enough and you got the wheel orders that gave you the right answer, then you had a little bit of a thrill that the job was up, but they never told you what was in it. And I've had to wait till now to find out.
I think if you'd said to Sergeant Jones and his eight Wrens and their three machines in March 41 that within 3 years there will be 300 of these things clanking away and there will be 3,000 of you and all the rest of it, I think
you'd be helping to turn a battle in France.
I think he would have, you know, fallen down with shock. But, you know, mighty oaks from very small acorns grow, and that's an exact case of that, that it was 75 years ago this month that that first acorn appeared of those first eight women, and off we went. And like so many of the roles at Bletchley, it must have been very hard work and very dull. Just shift work over and over again, setting these machines up and getting the stops out, sending them off, setting the machine up again, constantly fitting the rotors and taking the rotors off again for years at a time. And it's a real tribute that these people were prepared to put up with those kind of terms and conditions. And people get this idea that the story is about small numbers of Cambridge boffins. It's not. It's about large numbers of ordinary people doing quite mundane things very diligently for the greater good and not knowing until a long time after how important it actually was.
I'm going to London on my next free weekend. Theatre, film, all cut price for service folk. I'm going to see Sid Field and hear Zoe Gale sing. I'm going to get lit up when the lights go out in London.
Job up. Job up, girls. At last. Well done. Strip the machine down as fast as you can. You're moving on to the next menu.
Job up, Amy. Prayers answered. We got the right settings. Now, please, give it to them, lads.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk, find us on iTunes and Twitter, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audio Boom, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. And if you like the Bletchley Park podcast, don't be shy, write a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.